Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Dr. Sophie to our weekly podcast. I appreciate you guys listening and weighing in, voicemails, emails, all that kind of stuff. It's really helpful and it's really informative. And I hope you're getting some good stuff out of these podcasts because we really do our best to give you the best. And if you have suggestions, changes, anything you'd like to see differently, please let us know. This week, we are talking about something that I think affects a lot of people, whether it's really a disorder that affects our lives or it's not risen to that level, but it's still intrusive. We are talking about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And we want to get the most out of this to understand really what it is about, how we treat it, and how do we know if we even have it or if a family member has it. So stay tuned. We're going to talk about a lot of things OCD today. You can always find me, remember, at 1-855-767-4966 or 1-855-SOPHIE-NOW. Each caller will receive a free signed copy of my book, Side by Side, The Revolutionary Mother-Daughter Program for Conflict-Free Communication. But before we do that, stay tuned. Come on back. We're going to be talking to Carolyn Gregoire of the Huffington Post. Hey, welcome back. It's Dr. Sophie. We're going to jump right to Carolyn Gregoire of the Huffington Post. I want to see what her choices are this week because she has such interesting stuff that they put up that really touches mental health on many levels. So joining me now is Carolyn Gregoire of the Huffington Post. How are you? Welcome.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's always wonderful to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You have a new book coming out, don't you?
I do. I have a book on creativity, which I co-wrote with Scott Barry Kaufman, who is a psychologist at Penn, who does positive psychology and imagination stuff. It's coming out in December.
So. Exciting.
Thanks. Very excited about it.
Well, we'll have to hear more about it as it's getting closer.
Absolutely.
So tell us what you picked this week.
So my first pick this week is a piece about cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's specifically about a particular technique that's used in cognitive behavioral therapy, which anyone can kind of do on themselves, and it can help to sort of alleviate negative thoughts or a bad mood. And this technique is called Socratic questioning. Is this something you're familiar with?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is when a therapist uses kind of a series of questions to help someone kind of challenge self-destructive thoughts. So, for instance, someone who's struggling with feeling like a failure after they've just went through a difficult divorce, a therapist might start with a question, well, is everyone who experiences divorce a failure? And then the patient will answer. And then they'll say, well, can you think of anyone for whom that's not true? And they'll go on to another question, maybe, what evidence is there that you are actually not a failure, that you've succeeded in some way? And it can kind of go on from there. So you can imagine how, you know, if you're having some really self-judgmental thoughts, you can take a step back and say, well, so I had a bad week at work. Does this mean that I've had a bad year at work? What have I done that actually shows that maybe things aren't so bad? And it's really a powerful way to recognize that not everything we think is true.
That's 100% right. And it's such a great tool to have like in your back pocket and you could do it yourself because how many people get lost in the emotional responses to I'm a failure and they start to tumble down emotionally.
Totally. And because it can really be a spiral. And I think we really fall into a trap of believing our thoughts. And, you know, sometimes just it doesn't take that much to step back and get more perspective and to see that these things are not accurate. They're just a product of our emotions and the way we're feeling at the time. So this is just kind of a great way that anyone can experiment with gaining a little more control over their thoughts or at least loosening the grip of some, you know, sometimes really sticky negative beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, also, I think the earlier you implement it, the better. So the first negative thought you have, it's like stopping the bleeding, and then it doesn't get so bad. And then the more you practice it, the more proficient you are at it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the great things about CBT is that it does kind of teach people to be their own therapist, if you will.
Right.
So it's really geared towards like let me learn how to engage with my own thoughts, my own moods in a way that's productive.
100%. I love that. It's very empowering. So what's number two?
So the next one is about perfectionism, which is a thing that a lot of us struggle with, especially women. And, you know, a review of, you know, a ton of research over the past 20 years has found that in addition to all of these other things that are kind of destructive about perfectionism, it also contributes to burnout at work and at school. So we know that people who have perfectionistic tendencies tend to have more health problems, more stress, depression and anxiety can be an issue. And all of these things, just this level of pressure that perfectionists put on themselves can really lead to some bad things in their work and at school. And it kind of just creates a level of exhaustion eventually that is going to really hurt someone.
And are there any ways to prevent that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, overcoming, if you've been a perfectionist your whole life, it's not easy necessarily to let go of that. But, you know, there are some, you can emphasize the more positive aspects of perfectionism, which is setting high personal goals and really being proactive and working towards those goals. And then at the same time, limit the more negative aspects of perfectionism, which is, you know, being really hard on yourself when you make mistakes or seeing things in very black and white terms. So, you know, saying I'm a failure if I don't get this promotion, and if I do, then I'm a success. And, you know, it's just awareness, again, of those thought patterns and, you know, still having, again, high personal standards for yourself, but not getting so down on yourself with every little mistake.
And is there any benefit to learning from failure?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think a failure in so many cases is just a stepping stone to success. And, you know, more than that, it's just, it's completely unavoidable. We all experience failure. We all experience rejection. And, you know, that's not optional in life, really.
Right, right.
We all go there. And so, you know, it's really just the way that you engage with failure. Do you use it to teach you important lessons, which it really can, or do you... Does it hurt your self-image, and does it make you anxious or depressed or spiral into kind of negative self-beliefs and self-judgments? You know, we all kind of have the power to choose how we respond to failure.
Yeah, and I think the more you ignore the failure and pretend it doesn't exist, the more detrimental it is to you. So own it, learn from it. It's a teaching tool.
Absolutely, yeah. And just recognizing, too, that this is not... unique to you. Everyone experiences massive failures. And, you know, even Ariana Huffington loves to talk about how valuable failure is. And she talks very openly about her failures. And, you know, she's one of the most successful people around. So I think also just like being open about our failures and talking to people and not, you know, not building so much shame and privacy around it is helpful too.
And I think it's important that you pick this as a great article, because if we don't recognize ourselves as perfectionists, then we're never really going to be able to do the things we need to do to preserve ourselves and, you know, limit the aftermath of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me something. Why in the beginning did you say especially women suffer from this perfectionistic stuff?
Well, you know, there is some data suggesting that women tend to struggle with perfectionism a little bit more. I think there's a lot of pressure coming from a number of different areas for women to not only achieve and kind of get everything done and be on top of their lives, but also to look effortlessly beautiful and calm while they're doing it and to take care of everyone else. So it's just that pressure that women tend to kind of live with.
That's a lot.
Perfectionism.
That's not fair. We got to change that.
We do. I agree.
All right. So these are really great articles. We are looking forward to that book in December. Thank you, Carolyn Gregoire of the Huffington Post.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about OCD. So joining me today is my expert guest, Dr. Monica Williams. She is a well-studied, well-versed educator, psychologist. She is the director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities, love that word, at the University of Louisville in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, where she's the first minority female to be tenured in the department. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you not proud of all that stuff?
I guess.
Well, at least your parents are, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I think they are.
Do you have OCD?
Sort of.
No, I don't. But I've lived with OCD. I've had very close people to me suffer from the disorder. So I do know that it can be hard to live with it.
Okay, so tell me, like, from your perspective, how would you tell somebody what OCD is? Like, our listeners, how would you explain it in understandable terms?
Right. So most people kind of have an idea of what OCD is. They think usually about people who wash their hands a lot or who maybe line up their shoes by color. And certainly some people with OCD do these things, but that doesn't really capture the whole picture. What it is that people with OCD have thoughts, just like all of us. We have random, what we call junk thoughts sometimes, that maybe are weird or don't make sense, and we just ignore them. But people with OCD grab onto some of these junk thoughts, and then they start to really worry that those things could be true, and they can't stop worrying about them. And then they do these things called compulsions to try to make it better.
So give me an example, please.
Right. So, I think, you know, you might have had the experience where you're crossing the street and maybe you have the thought, I could push that guy in front of this oncoming bus and he would die. And then, of course, you don't do it, and you think, well, that was weird, and then you don't think about it again. But someone with OCD, they would think, oh, my gosh, I had that thought. Maybe that means I want to do it, and then they can't stop worrying about it. So they might go to extreme lengths to keep people around them safe, even though they're very peaceful people.
Got it. Is it really like, well, how do you tell if somebody has it or not, or is it, if they're just kind of a little neurotic or a little worrisome or a little too clean or they're worried about their hands versus somebody who has a disorder? How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, well, all of us, I think, have had times where we thought, well, what if I left the stove on or what if I didn't lock the door?
Right.
And we went back and maybe we checked it once or maybe we even checked it twice. But someone with OCD, once or twice wouldn't be enough. So they would be going to extreme lengths, maybe checking things over and over again, asking people for, feedback or reassurance or just trying to get excessive amounts of confirmation that their fear isn't true. And so that's how, you know, it's kind of crossed over into that clinical level.
And why can't someone who has OCD, why can't they let go of the thought of dirt on their hands or the stove is not off or the door is not locked or whatever? Why can't they let go of those things versus somebody who does not have the disorder who can think of it once and let it go?
Right. Well, it comes down to just a little malfunction in the brain circuitry, and I'm not going to try to get into the details of all of that, but let it suffice to say that there is a little malfunction which is keeping the thoughts from kind of normally progressing in and progressing out and making them, you can sort of think that they get stuck. So
they're not moving as freely in the OCD brain as they are in a non-OCD brain.
Right.
They get kind of stuck and they just circle around.
They circle around, and then the more compulsions a person does, the stronger that makes the obsession.
Like, give me an example. Because the compulsions are the behaviors, correct?
That's right. But let's say someone has worries that they have germs on their hands, and they wash them. Well, then they feel better temporarily. And so when that worry comes again, they remember, oh, yeah, I washed my hands, and I felt better. So then they wash them again. And so what happens is then the obsessions come back quicker and faster. The person does more and more compulsions, and that's why the disease is progressive over time.
So the repetition making your thinking feeling better, the more you repeat the behavior that you think makes you feel better, the more you're making the disease worse.
Exactly.
And then how does somebody really, they don't control it, even if they see it happening. Do people who are doing this actually think it's odd, or are they just sitting there saying, no, my hands are dirty?
Well, they know that their behaviors are over the top.
Do they?
They do. They know it's excessive, but they're not sure where the line is between what's reasonable and what's too far. So they think, well, just in case.
Yeah.
You know, just in case I might have germs, or just in case I might do this bad thing, let me take this extreme measure.
So are there varying levels of the disorder of OCD?
Sure. It's a continuum from people with what we would say have subclinical symptoms to mild, moderate, severe, and extreme. And extreme people are completely disabled. Often they can't leave their homes, and they have to have other people care for them because of the disorder.
And do you tell people, like, what are the first steps you would take to like even start to address this? Should they go to their doctor, like if they think they have it, if they're thinking of it twice, if they wash their hands more than once or twice, do they have it? Where do they start? It's scary.
Right. Yeah, it can be really scary. So, well, one great resource is the International OCD Foundation, and they have a website with just all the information you could ever want about OCD. So that's where I would suggest people start. I would also say it's really important to see a mental health care professional. Okay. Unfortunately, most mental health care professionals don't have a lot of experience with OCD, and it tends to get misdiagnosed quite a lot. So you want to make sure that you're consulting with someone who has a lot of experience with OCD, because it can look so different among different people.
Okay, so like it's not like a standard thing that we're looking for in somebody. Like if you look in someone's throat and they have an infection, or how you look at a depression, OCD has various presentations, you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, there's at least 60 or 70 different well-known symptoms of it. And you can have just a couple of those and have the disorder, whereas someone else who has it may have a completely different set of symptoms. So this is why it's so important that you get assessed by someone who knows what they're doing.
And why do you think there are so many different presentations?
I think it's because OCD tends to latch on to things that people care most about. And for every person, that's different.
Okay, that makes sense. I want to read you an email we got. Brian from San Francisco is asking us, my son is 11 years old, and he's a very neat kid. I'm a little worried because it's beginning to border on a little OCD, I think. For example, on his dresser in his room, he makes sure everything is lined up perfectly, and if anything is out of place, quote-unquote, he loses his mind. He immediately puts it back into place. Do we have something to worry about?
I would be a little concerned. Now, it's very normal for kids to go through phases where they want things to be ordered in a certain way or things have to be done just right. But if it's to the point where it's causing a disruption in your family routine, or it's causing a great deal of distress for the child, I would say it probably deserves, a look at by a professional.
Okay. Tell me something. There's a lot of articles out there and people talk about how there's a connection between OCD and IQ. Do you ever find that? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that is actually not true. I do hear people say that a lot, and I sometimes wonder if people say that as sort of a consolation prize. Well, I have OCD, but at least I'm really, really smart.
Right.
I think you see it in people of all different levels of intelligence, from very smart people to intellectually disabled.
So IQ really isn't an indicator of the two going together?
No, I think if you have a high IQ and you're really smart, might make it harder to treat you because you're going to try to outsmart your therapist.
Right.
But I don't think that means that, you're more likely to have OCD just because you're smart.
Got it. Okay. I want to play you a voicemail.
Hey, Dr. Sophie. I've been married to my wife for about 13 years, and we have a great relationship. However, honestly, every time she goes by the sink, she feels the need to wash her hands, and it's whether she needs to or not. And overall, she's just compulsively clean. And I know that it doesn't seem like it's a big deal, but sometimes, honestly, it drives me crazy. I've tried to tell her to pay attention to it and not to do it, but it seems like I can't really get through to her. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to deal with this.
He could always turn the plumbing off, then she can't wash, right? I'm sure you hear this all the time. I mean, what do you tell like family members and spouses and kids and all that kind of stuff, that it's a ripple effect? What do you say?
Right. Well, I mean, it's really tough, especially when someone's an adult. I mean, you can't really make someone get help for it unless they want to. But you can help them see how it's affecting you as a family member if you can find a way to share that with them without being angry, without accusing, just letting them know what a toll it's taking on you and how concerned you are about them, and maybe even make a few suggestions about where you might start in terms of getting some help or talking to a professional to, try to help the person see that it's more than, maybe just a little weird thing, but it's really a problem.
And how often do you think, or how difficult is it to get the person with OCD to really see that this stuff is out of the ordinary and over the top?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that there's a whole range, because some people, they're so miserable, they're willing to do anything to get better if they have it. Other people, you know, just aren't ready for help, and they may make the people around them very distressed, and the people around them who love them may be saying, you know, you've got to get help, and they dig their heels in. So, but, you know, it's really tough. If someone is determined not to get help, there's not much you can do.
Right, but it is true, though, someone suffering from it is aware that they're stuck in that, or not necessarily, or at a certain point they become aware of it.
I think most of the time people know that that something's not right. It's just sometimes it's hard to admit that.
Right. Okay. I want to read you an email from Deidre from Nashville. She's asking, my father suffers from OCD. He's always second-guessing himself. He never is sure if he shut the garage after leaving the house, and insists on double and sometimes triple checking after we leave the house. There are many examples, too, usually around our home, making sure everything is safe. I try to understand him, but it's not working for me. It's almost next to impossible. Are there any suggestions or methods you have for putting yourself in their shoes so I can try to better understand where he's coming from and not be so angry?
Yeah. So there are support groups for family members who struggle with OCD. And again, the International OCD Foundation might be a good resource for that. Also, the National Alliance on Mental Illness has family-to-family groups where people who have loved ones with some of these same problems can commiserate a little bit. But I think if you can talk to the person and just say, hey, help me understand this, sometimes they'll open up to you. If they feel threatened, or if they feel you're mad at them, that might be tough to get through. But I think just taking some time to try to listen to the person when you're not frustrated or angry can go a long way.
Okay. I mean, I think that's very helpful. And then have you found there are certain types of OCD that are easier to, like, address and treat versus other ones that are more difficult or non-reactive or, you know, they're resistant to treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I've had pretty good luck with just about every type of OCD. The issue, I mean, and there are lots of different types of OCD. You know, there's the contamination and symmetry and people with taboo thoughts or religious thoughts, lots of different types. But what I find can really get in the way of treatment is if the person is very, very depressed, you know, so depressed that they don't really have any motivation to engage in treatment.
And are they
or if they just really don't understand that they have a problem, and we say that they have poor insight, that can make the treatment tricky. Or if they just have trouble getting along with people in general, then that can be tough too, because, you know, they have to work with a therapist to get better, and those kinds of problems can get in the way of that. But all kinds of OCD do great with exposure and ritual prevention, and that's what I always recommend to people.
And tell me what those are.
So that's a type of therapy, a type of cognitive behavior therapy, where we help the person face their fears. And so the thing that they're afraid of, they practice confronting slowly at first in steps. So it's not all this big freak out. Right? And that's what people are often afraid of when they come to me. And I say, no, we're gonna try to hit this at a level where it's challenging but not overwhelming. So
like, give me an example. What's a typical treatment for you?
Right. So someone who's afraid of dirt and germs, you know, we might start with them just touching the floor with their finger. And then we might move up to them touching the bottom of their shoe. And then we might move up to, you know, touching doorknobs and then touching toilets. And then by the end of treatment, we're having a picnic on the toilet lid. So,
great. But what do you do with the symptoms that are coming out when they touch the floor and they start to freak out or they get anxious or they, like, what, you work them through that? Is that the whole process?
Well, the big challenge is to not do compulsions, right? So not to go wash or try to reassure themselves or do anything. They have to learn that the anxiety, it feels bad in the moment, but it'll go away all by itself without doing a compulsion. And once they start to learn that, usually the treatment goes pretty fast.
And then what's ritual prevention?
That's just a fancy way of saying don't do compulsions.
Ah, okay. So you just, you cannot, you know, you help them not get up and go wash their hands after they touch the floor. And you talk them through it, you work them through it, so that they then start to trust that they can soothe themselves through that.
Exactly.
Got it. That's interesting. So tell me again, you said there are several types of OCD. There was the contamination.
Right.
What else?
Well, contamination OCD, where people may wash a lot. There's OCD surrounding of symmetry and ordering, where people, you know, can't tolerate that things right. aren't just right. There's OCD where a person worries that they may have accidentally caused harm or a disaster. So they're constantly the ones checking doorknobs and light switches and faucets and ovens. And then there's what we call the unacceptable taboo thoughts category. And those are folks who are very worried that they're going to do something morally wrong. And often their OCD goes under the radar because a lot of their rituals are mental, because they're kind of constantly replaying things in their head and reassuring themselves that they're okay. And so that one tends to get missed a lot.
Now give me an example of that one.
Well, one type of obsession that comes up a lot in this category is what we call sexual orientation obsessions, where people actually worry that their sexual orientation is going to change. So they're constantly seeing how they feel around people of the same sex or the opposite sex to try and determine if their sexual orientation has changed.
Wow. That's really heavy.
Yeah.
Like, where is that rooted in? What's the core of that? Is it them not being comfortable with themselves to begin with?
Not necessarily, although sometimes it can be from that. But I often see this in young adults, because their sexuality is really an important part of their identity.
Right.
And so the fear then is that they're gonna lose people they care about, or they're gonna, you know, lose their attraction of the opposite sex. And so that starts to consume them. And it's really not about being homophobic or anything like that. It's just, you know, one common way that OCD can manifest.
Wow. And how do you deal with that? How do you treat that?
Well, oftentimes people with this kind of OCD are doing a lot of avoiding. So they may, you know, they may avoid going places where there's, maybe they avoid going to the gym because they're going to see other people that they worry that, what if I'm attracted to that person? So an exposure, we might go to the gym or the swimming pool or places where there's lots of attractive people and have
right.
them, you know, practice facing their fear.
And in reality, they're not really attracted to those people, just this fear of it.
Exactly. It's just a fear.
And what kind of medical treatments have you, you know, dealt with and worked with as far as treating OCD, besides the exposure and the cognitive behavioral stuff? Anything?
Well, yes, there are medications that can be helpful for OCD. For most people, if their OCD is, you know, beyond mild, the medications are not going to be sufficient. So they may help a little, but they're not going to, you know, make it go away.
So you need a combination, is what you're saying. Of medicine
and
treatment.
They need a combination, and I encourage people to try the therapy first, because a lot of times the therapy works so well they don't even need medicine.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of people, especially people with the most severe OCD, are going to need both.
Got it. So tell me a little bit about you, and I will set you free.
Okay. A little bit about myself?
Yeah. How do we find you and all your great knowledge and works, and get to you if we have questions or any of our listeners need to ask you anything?
Right. Well, I am in Louisville, Kentucky. So I'm at the University of Louisville, and I also have an OCD clinic called Louisville OCD Clinic. I know, not an original name.
Right. But, well, at least we could find it. It's not hard to find.
Not hard to find, and I've got a great team of therapists, and we see a lot of OCD, and that's what we do. We know OCD when we see it. We eat it for dinner, and we can help most people.
So. Got it. So we can find you at which website?
You can find me at Louisville OCD Clinic.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Dr. Williams, thank you so much for your time, your expertise, and all the people you're helping. It's really very nice. And congratulations on breaking all these new first woman things.
Thank you.
Be proud
thank
of you.
You. It was really great being on the program.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Have a great day. So that was the daily expert for us. It was Dr. Monica Williams. She is a expert in OCD. She's the director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Louisville. She also runs the Louisville OCD Clinic, which you can find her at www.louisvilleocdclinic.com. Really knowledgeable woman. She's very accomplished. But she had us really learn about four key things that I'd like you to take away from today, but also go back and listen through all of this because it's very interesting stuff. OCD is not what you think it is all the time. We learned from Dr. Williams that OCD is really a issue of thoughts that get trapped within our brain and the circuitry is breaking down, and that's the simple version of it. But once those thoughts are trapped within our mind, the only way we can feel better to get them out is to do a behavior, and that is the compulsion part of the OCD. So obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviors, and those compulsive behaviors are really the self-soothing tool we as individuals come up with to soothe those obsessive thoughts. And for example, it's the hand washing. You're getting stuck with the thought of being dirt on your hands or having dirt on your hands or having, you know, the locks unlocked or did I turn the gas stove off or whatever that thought is. And then the behavior to soothe that becomes turning off the stove or going back to check, washing your hands, doing all those kinds of behaviors. The issue is that it can't stop sometimes because the thought stays there and the behavior has to keep going until the thought diminishes. And the only way the thought will diminish is the behavior to be done over and over and over again until it really kind of erases it out of your brain. But the problem is that could stop your life. You could be there for hours washing your hands or going back to check the stove. So that's really what OCD is, and that's a really key thing to understand. The second thing I thought that was important for us to know is that there are varying degrees of OCD, whether you have the disorder actually or not, or if you just have the traits that kind of trickle in and out of your life and kind of just are there, but they're not intrusive. They don't stop your ability to live. They don't stop your ability to interact with others and have relationships and those kinds of things. So there is a spectrum and a timeline and a severity list of OCD. And that goes from anywhere of subclinical, meaning it doesn't really rear its ugly head, to extreme, which I can't leave my house because of the behavior. So anywhere between those two posts, you can have a continuum of symptoms of OCD. So depending on where you fall in that, that's what will dictate the kinds of treatment you need. I think the third thing we need to understand is there are 60 to 70 types of OCD-like behaviors that most people have seen. And Dr. Williams has told us there's about 70 of them that she's seen that are really important to know and really things that need to be treated. So if they are of a severe nature, then of those 60 or 70, they have to be treated because the behaviors are interfering with your ability to function. And also she showed us and told us that OCD is not at all connected to IQ, because many times you'll hear, well, I have OCD, but at least I'm smart. And that's not necessarily a correlation that can be made. OCD can be found anywhere on any IQ scale. And I think the last thing we need to take away and understand is there's lots of help out there for family members and for treatment of the disorder itself for the patient. We need to reach out. And she said the treatment that is the most effective is cognitive behavioral therapy. And the two forms that she basically uses and has the most success with are exposure therapy and ritual prevention therapy, basically exposing you with her help to the actual behavior that is creating the anxiety you have. So if you're afraid of dirt, touching the floor and working through that feeling and the tolerating of that anxiety so that you can learn then to do it again without the behavior. So breaking down the thought and the behavior in exposure and ritual prevention is the best treatment, she says. Also, medication is indicated at times because the symptoms may get in the way. But overall, the two effective treatments are her behavioral therapies of exposure and ritual prevention. And there are tons of support groups out there for family members. And she says the best place to get any information if you're a patient or a family member or just want to learn about it is the International OCD website, which she says is accessible anywhere and has a ton of resources locally and globally. So that was OCD. I hope you learned a lot. Go back and listen through it. There's a ton of stuff in there, and there's some great resources. Thank you for listening, and thank you for calling in today. Love your voicemails. Your emails are very helpful. They provoke a lot of thought and a lot of good questions. Remember that podcasts are on my website and on iTunes free of charge. My website is www.drsophie.com. My phone app is available in the iTunes store, so go check it out. Voicemail is there 24/7, 1-855-767-4966. My book, Side by Side, The Revolutionary Mother-Daughter Program for Conflict-Free Communication. Get it free if you call in, but you can have it. It's going to be a great book in case you're fighting with your child. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook for any updates and finding out where I'm landing. Visit iTunes to download the full version of Andy Grammer's Keep Your Head Up. And the most important thing is don't forget to sweep. Thank you.